This episode is sponsored by Macmillan Audio. If you're in search of an audiobook you won't be able to stop thinking about, you'll want to download Hope Ablaze next. Written by Sara Mughal Rana and narrated by Farah Kudwai, this is a powerful coming-of-age story about a Muslim teen who is illegally frisked at a Democratic senatorial campaign rally and then writes a scathing poem about the experience that goes viral. Hope Ablaze combines prose and verse and is perfect for fans of one of my all-time favorite books, The Poet X. You may also know the author from her podcast, On the Right Track. Start listening to Hope Ablaze by Sara Mughal Rana now, wherever audiobooks are sold. Hello and welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm your host, librarian and writer, Laura Zaro-Kopinski, and today I'm speaking with Melody Edwards, author of Once Persuaded, Twice Shy, A Second Chance Romance and Modern Reimagining of Persuasion. Melody Edwards is also the author of the beloved Jane Eyre retelling, Jane and Edward. She has a bachelor's from the University of Toronto, a master's from McMaster University in Syracuse, studied comedy writing at the Second City Training Center, and works in communications. And I want to share this blurb from Ashley Winstead, which I think sums up this wonderful book so well. She says, "Reading Melody Edwards is the closest you can come to reading a modern-day Jane Austen. Fans of Austen will find Once Persuaded, Twice Shy a gorgeously romantic homage to one of history's best second-chance romances and most relatable protagonists. Edwards' narrative voice is exquisite, her Anne Elliot perfectly rendered, her Wentworth swoon-worthy, and her small-town setting, Kelly Lynch Hall, exchanged for Kelly Lynch Winery, a place you'll ache to visit. This gem of a story is the persuasion update we deserve." I love that. I think she captures it so well. I could not have adored this book more. I wanted to just like live with these characters and be a part of this world. And I had to find out what happened. I think I stayed up until like one in the morning reading it because I just needed to know if these two were going to get together. Although, of course, you know, it's loosely based on persuasion. So I should have been able to just, kind of trust. But, Melody, just congratulations on Once Persuaded, Twice Shy, and thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, and thank you so much for that lovely, lovely introduction and reading Ashley's blurb. I think Ashley writes blurbs better than I write books, actually.
She just captured what I was feeling so well. I was like, I'm just going to let her say it.
She's a great writer.
Yeah. Well, from the moment I heard the premise for this, I was so excited because Persuasion is my favorite Jane Austen book. I have such fond memories of reading it for the first time, and your book felt so true to the spirit of the original and to these characters. And so I'm so curious to hear how you went about, you know, reimagining this classic and also what made you want to take that on as your next book in the first place.
Sure. Well, Persuasion's my favorite Jane Austen too. So
yay.
I just want to live in that plot. Well, I did my first book, as you mentioned, it's a modern reimagining of Jane Eyre. And that came about because I had a very specific idea for Jane Eyre in a modern workplace. And I really lucked out, and that book got me an agent, and that book agent got me a 2-book deal. And so for the second book, my editor said, "We'd love another reimagining of another classic." And so I went, right, Persuasion is my favorite book, so let's do that. My favorite Jane Austen book. And it's tremendous fun. So the challenge for this one was, of course, you've got a whole romance with two characters who kind of don't want to talk to each other and don't want to make eye contact. So that was the kernel of my problem in this modern adaptation. And so a lot of the choices I made were to try to get around that fact or distract from that fact or trap them together somehow. And the book kind of followed from there.
And can you tell listeners a little bit about sort of the modern world you've imagined here and what your modern Anne's life is like?
For sure. So I've set the book in Niagara-on-the-Lake, which is a real place here in Canada. It's right near the American border. In fact, you can peer across the water and see America if anyone wants to visit. And it's a lovely little small town that's sort of trapped in history, a bit like Colonial Williamsburg. But it's also a tourist resort. There's spas, there's golf courses, there's tons of wineries. And there's a lovely theater production company called the Shaw Festival. And they have a number of stages in town and they do a number of wonderful productions every year. And so what I did was I sort of took this lovely setting that I'm so fond of and I made it Persuasion. So Anne Elliot is, you know, one of the Elliots who have been multi-generational in this small town. And she is the executive director of the theater festival, loosely based on the Shaw Theater Festival. And she is a town councillor, so she's very important in the town. Because one of the aspects I wanted to sort of update, or not update so much as bring into focus about Anne, is people who read the original novel know she's often so sort of overlooked in wallpaper. And she's rather oppressed by the manners at the time, as you would be if you're an older with air quotes there, unmarried female in your father's house. But she is an incredibly competent character. You know, in the background, when her family's in debt, she draws up the budget. When her nephew falls ill, she takes care of him and rings the doctor. When a sister-in-law has an accident, she sort of triages as everyone else is frozen in horror. So she's a very competent character. So I took that aspect of her. And in modern times, I imagine she'd be incredibly career-driven, incredibly competent. So she's the town councillor. She runs a theater festival. And then what happens is her old college boyfriend comes back into town, broke up from 8 years ago, because his aunt and uncle have bought a nearby winery. And the winery is entering into a sort of a financial and real estate arrangement with her theater festival. So she's now got to sit opposite him from boardroom tables and negotiate. And it goes from there.
Well, their relationship does not disappoint. You know, in the original, that's one of my favorite romantic storylines. And this one was, you know, just as swoon-worthy. And I loved the Wentworth character that you created here as well. And I would kind of love to hear just any advice you have for writers hoping to create chemistry between characters and really build those sort of swoon-worthy relationships. Anything you did to kind of help, you know, make us root for those characters in that relationship?
Oh, that's a great question and a tough question. Sometimes I'm not even sure I've gotten the tension or the swoon on the page until an early reader tells me I did it. I'm like, oh, good, that happened. Excellent. For me, though, I think it starts with having very fully realized characters. And I'm sort of cheating a bit there because I'm borrowing heavily from Austen with her characters. And she creates such brilliant heroes and heroines who, you know, so psychologically complex and so unique that it's easy to imagine them in modern day. So I think it starts with that, to really see them as real people. And then the tension or the swoon, I think, is always just kind of having them ever so slightly misaligned. Because if you've got two people who are in love or want to flirt or anything like that, you know, if they walk up and say, well, this is how I feel, oh, you feel that way too, great. And I don't have a book. It's very anticlimactic. So it's always about a character says something and it's ambiguous or it's misinterpreted or it's miscommunicated or, you know, they make eye contacts and someone's embarrassed and looks away a second too soon, or, you know, they go to touch their hand and they hold on a second too long, or they leave a second too quickly. It's always about that slight misalignment, because it's almost like watching someone almost score in soccer and you're like, oh, so close. And then I think it's that, oh, maybe next time, oh, so close, oh, they almost missed the net. It's kind of that anticipation and emotional roller coaster that goes with it that leaves you feeling the romantic tension or the romantic swoon. And then at the end, when you finally bring it all together, then it's finally that feeling of being sated, that they've finally connected, they finally understand each other, and they're finally going off for their happy ending.
That's such a good way of putting it, a misalignment. And it's true, that really leaves us on the edge of our seat. Like, are they about to get it? Are they about to figure it out and get together? And I love that way of putting it. I think that's really helpful. And, you know, I'm wondering too, I read a quote from you where you were talking about the classic characters, you say, never really stay put. They find their way into present day over and over again, evolving with modern day values. I like to think all writers are part of a collective effort to help them along, finding new scenes and new forms for them to inhabit. Could you talk about that a little bit? And I feel that way, that these classic characters at least for me, I feel like they're always at the forefront of my mind and they are in conversation with the modern world. And yeah, if you could talk a little bit about sort of those classic characters in present day.
Oh, for sure. Well, as you mentioned in the intro, I did my undergrad at the University of Toronto and I studied literature. So I went deep into the classic characters and had a good time with that. I think when people look at something like Jane Austen and they say, God, what a commercial industry that's come out of her. The adaptations and the retellings and the films and the TV series and the modern retellings. There's stage plays, there's musicals, like it hundreds of years now, and it just keeps going. And you know what? We gobble it up every time. Every time we go and sit for Elizabeth finding Darcy in whatever form that comes in. And it's always this question of why are we so addicted to that? And I think when you've got these classic novels, when they've really created wonderful characters, and I think we're dealing with a time where, realism's kind of coming into novels, and the birth of psychology is right around the corner. When I think of a Jane Eyre or a Jane Austen, the characters themselves are so unique and so real that even with the manners and the clothes and those cultural differences, you can picture them in modern times. I feel like most women, if you talk to them, will say, "Yes, I have met a Mr. Collins who awkwardly tried to ask me to dance." And you feel a little bad for him, but you're also like, "Get away from me." So I think those characters ring true. Yeah, that's just it for me. And I think we still love the lessons. I think we all kind of want to be Elizabeth. A lot of women want to be Elizabeth Bennet. And I think the lesson is sort of a universal one that she falls for the Wickham. She falls for the flattery. I know I'm switching to another Austen book, sorry, but I'm just going with Pride and Prejudice because it's top of mind. She falls for the flattery of Wickham. And then when that's all over, she goes, "Oh, right. It was really weird, actually, that he did this and this and this." And she's overlooked Darcy, who's, kind of tall and awkward and silent in a corner. And I think, if you go into an office, we've all seen the slick salesman who's flattering and falls for it and is charming. And really, you should probably be looking at the awkward accountant in the corner who's actually the nice guy. So I think the lessons of these characters carries forward. And I think the stories are so good that we just can't let them die. We have to just keep carrying them over and over again, the same way we do with Shakespeare. And I'm sure there's artists that we have today that maybe in 200 years will be carrying forward their works as well. We've yet to find out which ones those are. I just think when they hit some kind of truth in the personality or the psyche or the story, then we just keep carrying it forward like a torch.
Well, you're making me think too that one of the things that those classics make so relatable, or Jane Austen's works in particular make so relatable, are the family dynamics. And that's such a big part of this story as well, and rings true again. And sort of what do we owe our families of origin, and, portraying them in all their quirks. Was it sort of tricky for you to figure out what that modern day depiction was going to be in this book?
Yes, the family was tricky because that's one of those elements where the old-fashioned Jane Austen rules really don't translate. The characters translate, but the social rules don't. In Jane Austen's time, she's got this awful family, of course, the character of Anne. And she's stuck there. She can't get a career. She can't go and earn her own income. Unless she marries, she's within her father's house under her father's rules. And in modern times, we'd say, if your family's awful, we'll get up and leave, move towns, have a text message relationship instead of being in their kitchen every day. And so it was tough to construct a relationship where her family was sufficiently awful, but she has a complicated relationship enough with them that she won't leave, that she feels responsible for them and connected to them still. And how I did it with Anne is sort of that her mother had created this happy family life, and in the absence of her mother, Anne fell into supplying the same role and trying to keep it all together. And with the busyness of her career and the busyness of other aspects of her life, she didn't really notice how awful her family was all the time, or how much she was doing to take care of them, but at the same time enable them. She hadn't realized what that relationship looked like. And I think that is something people can relate to when you're in the depths of a relationship and you suddenly take a step back and go, "Well, wait a minute, what does this actually look like?" And so I tried to give her that realization in the book. And then how can she move forward without throwing away entirely, you know, her origin and the people that came with it, but having a healthier distance?
Yeah, I thought it was just so interesting to see as each sort of facet of Anne's character and life is made modern day. It's just done so well that you feel like, oh, that's so true to the spirit of the original, but makes so much sense for now. And I thought the family portrayal was definitely that way. I really liked that a lot. And, you know, I'm wondering too, you mentioned a little bit about the town, which is really, excuse me, which is really almost like a character as well. And I loved the community. I loved all of the, you know, their festivals and just, it has almost like a Stars Hollow feel to it, which I always love. And I'm curious how you went about really making us feel, you know, like we were there and connected to that setting. Did you spend a lot of time in that town? And, you know, just all of the sensory details were so rich and all of that kind of through, you know, through time there and through seasons. How did you go about really bringing that place to life on the page?
I love that you said it's got a Stars Hollow vibe, because I'm hearing that a lot. I'm like, yes, excellent, nailed it. Because I was a big Gilmore Girls fan back in the day.
I'm currently rewatching it, so that's probably why it was friend of mine too. It's like, yes, this is tremendous. Very Stars Hollow.
And Stars Hollow in the fall, always in the fall.
Yes.
I had an early reader actually who said this is Stars Hollow meets Park and Rec. And I was like, oh, interesting. I kind of like that. I did spend a lot of time. So I grew up not too far from Nagano Lake in Toronto. It's a little less than a 2-hour drive. So you can go for the day or go for the weekend. And I grew up going to it quite frequently. And particularly in the pandemic, when people were looking for outdoor activity, there's a lot you can do outdoors in the town. So I ended up going a lot. And then for the second novel, I knew I wanted to use it as a location. So that was an excuse to go back even more often and book a lovely hotel and go to the lovely wineries and have a good time.
There you go.
Capturing it was just something I've seen so frequently. It was capturing it with fresh eyes. And it really was a head scratcher for me how to relate this to someone who's never seen it, because it's such an odd compilation of parts with the heavy tourism, but also the small town feel, that there's tractors in the fields, but there's, you know, coach buses of tourists coming at the same time. And there's a 18th century hotel and there's a 19th century ice cream shop and a strange graveyard in the middle of town. And it's all very unusual. So, and I don't even feel I captured the half of it really. But it was just going for, I looked closely at the aesthetic of it, I guess, describing the storefronts, because it's really quite spectacular when you first walk down the main strip, and then thinking about how small the community is, that you'd bump into people you know, and what that would look like, and then really just going into my favorite haunts and finding ones with a mood that would pick a particular scene. So Anne, as you know, has a very embarrassing scene with her father in what is called the Winston Churchill Lounge, which is a pub attached to the Prince of Wales Hotel. And that is a lovely, calm, soothing, intimate sort of little pub. It's just absolutely delightful. And so I thought that is a place where you go relax and, you know, you can almost see every table and things like that. It's very intimate. So I thought I'm going to give her just the most mortifying, awful spectacle there that will contrast with this lovely calm mood, and that there's really no corner to duck around. Everybody's going to see it. So it was just kind of doing a matching game that way from particular parts of the setting to what I wanted the book to do.
I love the idea of grounding particular scenes in real locations. And it makes me wonder, did you feel constrained at all at times of, oh, I really want something to happen here, but that wouldn't have made sense for the town, or like wanting to make something up, but then feeling like, well, should that be real? Like, did you have any push-pull with it being a real town?
I probably should have, but you know what? I took tremendous liberties. So there's Kellynch Winery which is a big feature of the book, is actually a winery quite far outside of town. I think it's in a place called Grimsby, which is like the town before Niagara-on-the-Lake. And I thought there was a particular winery that I absolutely loved. It was beautiful. I'm like, I'm just going to mentally airlift that winery to the town I wanted in. So while a lot of it is accurate, the particular stores I name, the particular hotels I name, the Irish pub at the end, like those are all very real. I might have played around a little bit with geography sometimes if I needed a character to walk from location A to location B and they needed to have a longer conversation. I just thought, well, I'll just mentally add in a little bit more sidewalk there. So if you go to Niagara-on-the-Lake, I think you'll recognize scene for scene all of the places and all of the atmospheres right down to the hiking trails. But where they are in relation to each other might be a little different. And the characters are all fictional. So I made the board of directors of the theater festival just awful. And I'm sure the board of directors of the Shaw Theater Festival in real life are lovely. I've never met them, but I'm sure they're lovely. So I hope people will know that part's all fiction.
Well, when you bring up the hiking trails too, there's some great scenes that involve hiking, some sort of present ones and more of like a flashback too. Are you a big hiker? How did that sort of come to be that those sort of storylines?
I became a big hiker in the pandemic. We have lovely hiking trails here in Ontario, just all over the south of Ontario. It's really some gorgeous landscapes. And early in the pandemic, we had been lockdowns for a long time, and the only way to socialize safely was to go outdoors. And so hiking became a really big thing. And some of the trails actually got so crowded, you had to reserve a parking spot so that they wouldn't be overrun. And I really got into it and I loved it. And I got my hiking boots and just went out. And I went with some friends to Niagara for the weekend because I'm like, I'm writing a book here. Let's go find some hiking trails. And we found some spectacular ones that you go right down to the Niagara River, which leads into Niagara Falls, the famous Niagara Falls. And we didn't really know what we were doing. It was supposed to be like a 40-minute hike, and I think it turned into 3 hours, but spectacular settings. And I'm going to probably try and put some up on my Instagram, but nothing short of being there in person, I think, can capture how spectacular it is. But I hope I grabbed a little bit for the book. So I am not an expert hiker like Anne and like Wentworth, but I am a very fond hiker now. I go out quite often.
Yeah, I loved those scenes. And it also, again, feels like the perfect modern version of, the long walks everyone takes in Jane Austen books and everything with those heroines taking their, very long walks. Like, oh, in a modern day, that would be a hike. And,
You're right, I didn't even think of that. That works out neatly.
Well, there's so many things I feel like went after you kind of make the modern version. I go, oh, I wouldn't have come up with that, but that's so right. That's what it would be. So I thought it was so fun to see all of that play out. And it has me wondering, have you picked a next heroine? Is that the kind of book you'll do next? Or are you able to say anything about what your next project will be?
Well, I am working on my next project. I'm always a little nervous to say something about it because I did an interview, I think, like a month or so ago, and I gave some details. And then in working on my draft in the last 2 weeks, I'm like, wow, those details all just got wiped out. I redrafted that. I am working on an original plot right now, which is nerve-wracking for the first time. Original characters, original plot. And as more of a little bit of an international romp this time instead of restraining myself to one Canadian location. Though I do love Canadian locations, and this one is going to start in Ottawa, which is our capital city. But when this book's complete, I do want to revisit more reimaginings because they're so much fun to do. There's so many great ones out there. Like you're almost spoiled for choice. There's Elizabeth Gaskell's North and South, which if you haven't read the book, check out the mini series from I think it's like 2008. It's fantastic. And there's also I'd Love to Rescue Mansfield Park. I know no one loves that book, but I love it. And I feel like Fanny in modern times would perhaps go a rather different path than we're used to. So there could be some fun with that. And there's more Austens, there's more Brontes, there's so much more to do. So
Yeah. Oh, that will be fun. And I'm excited to read the original book as well. And, that's making me wonder too, are you able to share anything about what your writing process is like? Right now, if you're sort of in the midst of drafting, what does that look like for you? Are you sitting down for a certain number of hours a day? How do you balance that with sort of wearing your promotion hat? What's your creative process like?
Sort of a mess. my very first book, they have this term, a planner versus a pantser. You're flying by the seat of your pants. I was kind of a pantser on the first book, and I didn't know what would happen and if it would turn out. And I feel like I kind of won a lottery ticket that I got an agent and I got a deal from it. And my agent and my editor are both amazing women, and I'm so lucky to have them. For the second novel, I felt I'd mastered a lot of learning curves on the first one about how plots work and how readers respond. And, my editor, Kate Seaver over at Berkeley, was really great in detailing the process. So for the second book, I sat down and I wrote a plan. And what it is I write an outline of the characters, and then I lay out the seminal events in the original Persuasion, like the Louise's accident and things like that. And then I just kind of draw a dotted line to the second half of the page and write what my modern equivalent will be. And then anything in between those events is just kind of me flying by the seat of my pants. So for this new novel, because it's original, I'm really doing the planning on this one. So we'll see how that turns out. It is tough to promote and write at the same time. I think my book's out in 2 weeks, a little less than 2 weeks, or exactly 2 weeks. So we're getting into the thick of promotion. I do feel a little bit of embarrassment sometimes because I'll do interviews and someone will ask about a detail of my book, and I'm like, did I write that? I don't remember that. You'll have to remind me of that, because I'm in a whole new cast of characters right now. And then people ask you questions about the original Persuasion, which I know back to front, and then I panic and I can't remember the details. So it's all kind of a learning process, but I have a great team. I really trust my team. I'm very reliant on my team. I have a master calendar that is like my Bible right now, and it's like rollerblading. The more I do it, the better I get, I think, at swinging between the books and following my plans and all sort of that thing.
Yeah, it really must be like living in two different creative worlds, and you're trying to go back and forth because, yeah, to be talking about Once Persuaded, you really have to kind of go back to that world, but now you're with all different characters, so that is very interesting to kind of be wearing both hats. Well, I always love to hear what authors have been enjoying in their own reading lives recently. Are there any books you'd want to recommend?
So I picked up this book in the store the other day, and I honestly just picked it up because I like the title and like the cover, but it's fantastic. It's called Murder Your Employer: The Guide to Homicide by Rupert Holmes. And I know I'm writing romance and I'm recommending a murder mystery here, but it's tremendous. It's a sort of bit of otherworldliness, dark academia, I guess you'd say, but it's tremendously funny. And it's a book about a school that teaches people how to commit murder.
Ooh.
That's people who want to commit a murder in their life, either because they've got a horrible boss or a horrible spouse, and they're tapped to go to the school, and they learn poisons and they learn how to lie and they learn all those things. And then their thesis, which is their graduation project, is to go out and actually commit the murder that they planned. But it's very, very funny and dark.
That sounds so good, actually. Just oh, I'm gonna have to definitely look that one up, and I will definitely link to it for whoever wants to pick it up. Very different, but what a clever premise. I like that. Well, Melody, I cannot gush about Once Persuaded, Twice Shy enough. And I think as someone who, is such a big Persuasion fan, it was a real treat to experience this modern reimagining. It is so true to the spirit of the original book and the characters, but with fresh twists and setting. And I loved the relationship between Anne and this modern Wentworth, and I loved this community. And so I really hope that listeners treat themselves and pick up a copy of Once Persuaded, Twice Shy. I think they will really adore it as much as I did. And I would imagine too, Is there an audiobook out soon for that too when the book releases?
Yep, there'll be an audiobook when it all releases on February 27th.
Oh, I bet it would be just a lovely audio listen as well to get to kind of escape to. So I hope that listeners also check that out. And just thank you so much for coming on and sharing more about the book and your process.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. This was tremendous fun.
For links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, you can visit abookishhome.com. If you are enjoying the show, I hope you take a minute to subscribe and also rate and review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would encourage you to share it on social media to help other people find the show and this episode. Thanks for listening, everyone, and happy reading.